Let me tell you about our new sponsor, Patriot Shave. Backed by over 2,000 five-star reviews and a satisfaction guarantee, Patriot Shave offers premium quality razors at affordable prices. While some razor companies have gone and supported a lot of the woke values, Patriot Shave has not. They support the values of hardworking men and women of America. For less than $20, you can get their Freedom Forged razor kit and be confident that your money, your hard-earned money, is not supporting woke values. Join the movement today and go to patriotshave.com and use promo code CDM for a 15% discount. That's patriotshave.com and use promo code CDM for a 15% discount. Or go to cdm.press and hit cdm.shave on the top menu. Thank you.
Psst. Your government doesn't care about you. That's why you need a medical emergency kit. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, Z-Pak, and antibiotics. Stock them before they block them.
Hi, everybody. I'm Christine Dolan. This is the Globalist in Plain Sight show. We're a little late today just because we're all traveling all over the place. And it's the, you know, dog days of the election, not the dog days of August, but the dog days of the election, getting involved. And we are honored. I'm very honored today to have Dr. Lisa Babich with us, who is running for the state Senate in the state of Georgia in District 5. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Christine. A pleasure to be here.
So you and I were just recently introduced, okay? And I want to get into your family heritage a little later in the show because I think it's absolutely fascinating. But first of all, let's just talk about the election overall. You've decided to throw your hat in the ring. You're a teacher. You care about kids. You care about education. You're certainly qualified to be the Secretary of Education in the United States with your background. But tell us about the value of education.
You know, I love that you said that I was qualified to be the Secretary of Education, because not only do I firmly believe that, I know that historically speaking, Blacks have been hindered from having the education required to have economic stability. So education is important for so many reasons, not just for Black people, obviously, but for all people. And when you consider what is happening on our southern border, when you consider the ideologies that are infiltrating our public schools, now more than ever, the focus should remain on education.
Well, you have your PhD. You have two masters, or you're working on your second?
I'm finishing my second master's in December.
All right. So just for curiosity's sake, I can hear people in the background saying, What does Dr. Babich have for, what was your PhD thesis?
Now, my PhD was about the ecological considerations of homeless shelters. I had a government and a nonprofit focus in my studies. And so I looked at how the environment shapes our well-being. And for those who are experiencing homelessness or any kind of trauma, the environment certainly plays a factor in how they're going to heal, or if they're going to heal.
Let's talk about that healing, because when your mother and father divorced, you and your brother actually lived in a homeless shelter. And I heard during one of your interviews talking about that, you know, at night, sometimes when they turn off the lights at a certain time, you know, you'd have to have that safety bond with your mom. You would basically stay awake. Talk about what the homelessness experience did to you in terms of trauma and not having a secure roof over your head.
I still don't quite have words for it. I mean, honestly, as you were describing that scenario, it brought tears to my eyes. We went into a homeless shelter in the state of Arizona in the 1970s when my parents first divorced. It was a Salvation Army shelter. I found a community in that shelter. That was the best shelter I was ever in. I unfortunately can say that the shelters in Georgia are far worse. Children are at dangerous risks in homeless shelters for being molested and raped. And it's just not a place for a family. Now, I'm thankful that we were not in the streets per se, but we were in the streets. You know, studies say that children who experience homelessness for 1 week lose up to a year of schooling. because the way that the trauma impacts the mind and the memory, it's very difficult for some children to overcome that time lost. I was homeless probably for 7 years as a child, on and off, from the age of six, I would say, to the age of 15.
Those are formative years. Those are formative years. Did your brother and you deal with it differently? Did it have different impacts?
I mean, I would say so in a certain regard. My brother and my younger siblings, who were not homeless with me, but did experience homelessness, they all were molested in the shelters. I did not have that experience. And I know that it shaped him as a man. You know, to be molested by a man as a young boy, you know, we don't have enough research on the impact that that has. And I believe it surely shaped both of my brothers who experienced that tragedy in homeless shelters.
Well, you know, there are some people that talk about, because when kids, the younger the children are molested, it can have compounded trauma effects. So that, and that's in the context of what Dr. Diane Lamberg says, who's a Christian therapist out of Philadelphia. Sometimes if the trauma is not addressed, if the healing doesn't happen, that people have a tendency to make what she calls clinically compounded traumatic decisions that basically send people down a slippery slope, whether it's to drugs, promiscuity, you know, breaking the law, having broken relationships, and ending up dead or in jail. So it does have its.
I can say for one of my brothers, everything you just described was his story. I mean, I did have an experience with drugs when I was younger as a way of coping with the trauma that I experienced. Unfortunately for my brother, he did turn to a life of crime as a result of everything that we went through in childhood, and he ended up dying in jail.
Many times women in detention centers, and I've actually gone into detention centers and asked them how many of them have been raped. And surprisingly enough, most of the hands go up. And then if you ask them, you know, how young they were, there's a lot of hands that are still up, you know, under the age of 10 or 4 or 5 years of age. What did you learn having that experience and then elevating yourself, knowing the value of education? Did you go to schools when you were, you know, between 7 and 15?
You know, we went sporadically. You know, we had my parents had a very laissez-faire grasp on education, even though both of them are highly intelligent. It was something about leftover from the hippie generation and just bucking any and every system that could be bucked. So for that reason, I probably missed over a year of school when you count all my absences and truancy. Eventually, I went to night school, a community college in Arizona, in order to graduate with my peers. So I was lacking so many credits that I wouldn't have graduated on time. My GPA, this is fascinating, I find, was 1.6 when I graduated high school. Yet I can sit here today with a PhD and two masters in effect. And it just shows the power of education, to be honest. You know, when I became a mom unexpectedly at 20 years old, I wanted my child to have every opportunity that I felt like I was not afforded. And I knew that education was a key. So it was at that time that I went back to school after getting pregnant freshman year and started pursuing my bachelor's.
So you have also taught in school.
Yes.
So let's talk about that, because that brings a really beautiful, you know, experience, even though part of it is traumatic, but the experience in the classroom.
Yeah. So I was thankful enough to be an adjunct professor at a small community Christian college, which was the icing on my cake. But the cake is really public schools. And I've taught in metropolitan Atlanta for 20 years. This is my 21st year teaching. Right now, I teach at a school that's 99% immigrant born. And what we're finding is that this first generation of new Americans that are coming here seeking a better life truly cannot compete in the educative world as the way it's set up. Then you have this whole other portion of Americans who generationally have not had a strong educational background. What we have here is a ticking time bomb, a brewing pot or cauldron, if you will. And right now we don't have anyone in higher ed that's making the right decisions for our kids.
So tell me why you decided to throw your hat into the ring. Because, I mean, right now, you know, it's a risk if people get involved in politics. It really is. I mean, more so because the criticism is so deep and people get, you know, emotional if they don't agree with somebody's opinions.
The risk is no greater than growing up in a government housing project running for your virginity. I mean, honestly, I felt like the Lord told me to run. That's what I'm going to do. You know, whether or not I win is up to a myriad of factors. Not one of them is my own insecurities about being in a political arena. But honestly, the gentleman who is representing where I live right now is doing nothing. He is not liked by Democrats nor Republicans. He is just a placeholder, and I feel like it's time for him to go. I'm a definite person that likes to see solutions, and I want to provide solutions for everyone who lives in Gwinnett County.
So let's talk about District 5.
Yeah.
Tell the audience where that is.
So Gwinnett County is northeast of Atlanta. It's in the suburbs. It was the most diverse and fastest growing county in America for 7 consecutive years. In my district alone, we have about 1/3 registered Republicans, 1/3 Democrats, and 1/3 true independent swing voters. It is extremely diverse culturally and economically. Gwinnett County is a rather large suburb. We have a huge voting base. And so it's really a decision maker for the state of Georgia.
So what are the odds that you're going to pull this off?
You know, it really depends on who you ask. I am very hopeful that those swing voters will find connections in the message that I'm sharing. You know, as I go to various events, and I'm one of the first, if not only Republicans, to go into Democrat areas and speak to Democrat voters, because I truly believe the Republican Party is not courting them in the way that they should. And so we have plenty conservatives who have voted Democrat in the past, and they resonate with the message. They resonate with the messenger. And that is very important. You know, marketing is all about what you see and what you hear. And what they're hearing from me, they can get behind. Even when there's a discourse, I offer my phone number at every event and I say, call me, let's talk about it. And I mean, that's something, access to politicians in that way is something I think people long for.
So what are the top 3 issues that you're hearing from people?
Yeah.
That you're responding to? What's your message to them?
So definitely education. And I call that our present, you know, our future. I'm sorry. So the way we treat our kids, the way we raise our kids, the way our kids are able to take care of us when we get in our senior years, that's important. So that's the future piece. Our present is economics. We've got a lot of opportunity going on in Georgia, but it's not filtering into District 5, number one. And number two, Gwinnett County as a whole has experienced a brain drain for, I mean, at least 2 decades. So we are really in a precarious situation, economically speaking, that we're going to have what is seen in Fulton County, where you have the upper echelon in the north part of Fulton County and dire poverty in the southern part of that county. We don't want that in Gwinnett, but we're truly setting ourselves up for that if we don't do something different. But I also have another heart issue, which is the elderly. I've been working with the Georgia Black Republican Council and various other organizations to make sure that we have legislation that promotes supporting the elderly, not only their real property, their right to vote, as their conscience dictates, their intellectual property. All of these things are not fully protected in Georgia yet. And I've been working on some legislation just to make sure that that happens. So our elderly is our past, the past, present, and future. I say, no matter what your issue is, I got you.
That's a nice message. I got you. Now, have you taken up your contributor to our Georgia Record paper? So have you taken on any of the issues outside of Gwinnett County in terms of the Fulton, you know, the RICO charges? Do you have any feelings about the RICO charges against Trump and Giuliani?
You know, it's very unfortunate that we find ourselves in this situation. I know when SB 202 came out, I was very vocal with a group of pastors and the message that Stacey Abrams was spinning. I have been very vocal against her. I know that Fulton County has a ton of corruption. And what is unfolding, the layers that are being peeled back, unfortunately, there's going to be some casualties along the way. But I do feel like President Trump will be exonerated in every one of these experiences that he's having right now. And I truly believe that it will only bring him more support, more justification for the way that he will run our country once winning that election in November.
So let's talk about the state of Georgia. Has voting started? Early voting started in Georgia.
Starts on Wednesday.
That's right. I knew we were around that. You know, the calendar for that. So what do you? I don't want to ask you predictions because you know we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But what are you hearing on the ground?
You know, it's funny, if children speak the truth, I will say that last week, as we were introducing government into my social studies class, after my lesson, the entire class said they were going to vote for Trump. Now these are sixth grade kids, but they come from Latino, Black, and white families, middle class, lower middle class, even families. And it says to me that the Trump message is still resonating with all of America. You know, the attack ads that Kamala Harris and Team Democrat have put out have been very convincing on one regard, but the truth is always more convincing. I do feel like there are a large number of independent voters that are going to come out for Trump. The question really is for Georgia is if they're going to go all the way down the ballot. Now, when I'm speaking to Democrat voters, I often tell them to zigzag across the ballot, because sometimes me convincing them to vote for President Trump is not something that's allotted in my 90-second spiel. But what I can do is convince them to vote for me. And once a study showed that once Democrats vote for a Republican, they're likely to vote for a Republican again.
Well, that's true. And if they vote for a Republican on the lower ballot, chances are that they vote for a Republican at the top of the ticket as well.
Correct.
So are you getting the support you need from the state Republicans?
What I'm getting is support from my local GOP. And I have to give a tremendous shout out to them, because historically speaking, the Gwinnett County GOP has not been engaged in local races as I feel they should have. But our governing body right now is truly taking up the mantle and partnering with all of the candidates. There's 13 of us that specifically that they're partnering with across the board, providing every area of support that we would want. And so I truly appreciate that. The state GOP is another animal. And I've been working with, as I said, through the Georgia Black Republican Council and through other organizations such as the Freckless Douglas Organization. I've been working with the RNC and GOP on strategy, on different initiatives. I think that we still have a lot of work to do and not a lot of time to do it. But I'm very proud of what Gwinnett GOP is doing right now.
All right. So let's get down to your parents was an interracial marriage, okay? Mm-hmm. And Kamala Harris' parents is an interracial marriage, Jamaican and Indian. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the female factor in the Democratic Party and how does it play to Black women? Because a lot of people sometimes say, oh, the first woman, so let's just go with that. What's your feelings about this race?
A lot. When you say a lot of people, that number can't be underestimated. So many people want to see these glass barriers broken down that they're willing to break them at any cost, even the cost to America's future. I feel that message is resonating with Black women and women of any color and denomination, because so many women have found themselves to be second-class citizens in a man's world, historically speaking, and they are looking for that brass ring, and Kamala Harris typifies that. You know, while I don't consider her any sort of prize whatsoever, many people do, because they're willing to settle and they're willing to go by superficial measures of achievement. And that's unfortunate that everyone's not a statistician. It's unfortunate that everyone doesn't do their research, but honest to God, that's the truth. I was at a gathering here in Arizona this past weekend. And, you know, the assumption when I come into a room is always that I'm a Democrat. And when I start espousing the platform of the Conservative Party, people are shocked and taken aback, but they listen. They listen because they're intrigued by, you know, what they presumed that it turns out is incorrect. And they are willing to hear some of the arguments that I have against Kamala sometimes.
All right. So let's give me three arguments against her.
She has, I hate to say she slept her way to the top, but she did not earn her way to the top. That's number one. You know, if you, most people of color, and I'll just say Black people right now, but most people of color have been overlooked for a job sometime in their past, just like most women have. Mm-hmm. They don't like that person that has circumvented the system to get to the top. Kamala Harris is chief in that regard. She has not earned. I mean, she only tried 10 cases, I believe, in California before, moving up because of the person that she was having an affair with, the mayor of San Francisco. So all of this is not a good look, just to put it plainly. This is not a person that you want to get behind. So that's number one. Number two, she has attempted to distance herself from Joe Biden when she's been complicit to what's been going on for 3.5 years. And to pivot on issues is really showing that she has no issue that she believes in, no backbone whatsoever. That's pretty clear. Even a 10-year-old has been able to see through that. She does not care about people as she exposes to care about people. And especially for Blacks, I feel like she is using them as the Democratic Party has since the 1960s.
You're also an author.
Yeah.
You've written several books. Let's talk about the Democratic Party and the Black population, because one of your books goes deep inside of it, which includes your profiling on Sanger from Planned Parenthood and also about Hitler and people that are eugenicists. Let's talk about that. What are your feelings when you're running, you're a registered Republican, you've gone through the experience of some people in the Democratic Party experiencing homelessness, picking themselves up by the boots, and having a life where there's a roof on your, you know, there's a roof over your head and there's a piano in your living room, all right? So let's discuss this, because I think, you know, it's a very powerful position that you're in, Lisa, because you know that the system in the Democratic Party has used the Black population and has not delivered. And you've written about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but this was intentional all along. You know, I do feel when Martin Luther King was arrested and requested help from our federal government, Republicans missed a great opportunity, being very short-sighted. And Democrats capitalized on it, and they've continued to capitalize on it ever since. You know, when we had referenced marketing earlier, we know that the Democrat playbook speaks to emotion, it speaks to trauma, it speaks to open wounds economically, and that is what gets people's attention. But they are using that data, that information, and that response in a manipulative way. Unfortunately, generation upon generation, we haven't seen Black families, because the other minority groups have not been here for that long, but we have not seen these families speak up in righteousness against what is happening. Many times when I am with the Black Republican Council, we will be at a public event and people will walk up to us and say, my grandfather was a Republican. That is the story that we hear all the time. What happened between grandfather and grandson? One, it is the influx of drugs and the criminalization of drug use in Black communities. And second of all is all the programs that the Democrat Party has promoted to take the man out of the home, make sure that the woman is getting compensated enough to survive and only do that, never to thrive. And, you know, in addition to that, you have this other plan B where you paint all white people as racist. You paint all white people as misogynistic. You paint all white people as the enemy. I mean, the term blue-eyed devil is so overused. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And for me, I had the blessing of being able to say, my father has blue eyes and he's white. Is he truly the devil? And, you know, it allowed me, it piqued my interest at a very young age to start questioning the rhetoric that I was hearing. And I'm thankful that in a government housing project, the elementary school that I attended was neutral politically. Even though I found out years later that all of my teachers were Democrats, they never pushed a Democrat message. Instead, what they pushed was individuality. They pushed a personal responsibility. They pushed equal opportunity. They actually pushed a Republican message, even though they were voting Democrat. And I'm so thankful for that, because it gave me, you know, the wind and beneath my wings to actually get to a point where I could decipher politics for myself.
It would be absolutely remiss not to ask this question before we get into your family history, which I find absolutely fascinating. Tell me your feelings, having been in the education field for such a long period of time, about the push of the trans ideology.
You know, what is really shocking to me, even though I'm looking at it every day, what's shocking to me is how underhanded this has become the norm. I know that the trans movement, and I'm not picking on any one person, but just the ideology, they went through school counselors to circumvent what was being halted at school board meetings when parents became aware through the pandemic of different things that were happening in their children's schools. So you go through school counselors because there's no true measure for the indoctrination that's happening. When we actually mandate that counselors have to allow masturbation in the classroom because it's a form of self-soothing, then we open the door to all sorts of sexual deviancy. When we assume that the child's rights supersede, the child's rights in that moment supersede what is right for them long term, we have gone down that slippery slope. And the idea, thankfully not where I teach, but the idea that someone would have a notation saying refer to a child by this name in the presence of parents, I mean, it's unconscionable, but yet this has seeped through everything. Now, I will tell you, in the state of Georgia, another group that I'm a part of, a Christian Association of Public Theologians, we've been working with the school superintendent to make sure that our laws are followed. We have a character education law on the books. It has been in effect for 20 years, I believe, yet it is not being implemented throughout the various school districts because there's no funding tied to it. What we did by taking a hands-off approach to education, we did not fund the things that were good for kids. Instead, we left it up to districts, and many districts that have progressive leadership went out and found funding for these horrendous programs that allow a child to believe that they can be she, he, it, or they. You know, how ludicrous. You know, it's hard enough going through puberty. It's hard enough dealing with peer pressure. It's hard enough dealing with the social media acceptance or insecurity. And you want to add on that we don't even have our own identity, that our identity is fluid, or that it can be predetermined by our whim on a given day. It's crazy. It's crazy.
So President Obama, when he was in the Oval Office, he pushed for the LGBT at the time, mm-hmm. Through the Department of Education and also the Department, State Department. And then when Biden came in, and I think it was June or July of 2022, he signed an executive order throwing the weight of the entire federal government behind LGBTIQ+. All right. Do you think that was a mistake from an educator's point of view?
It was a mistake from every lens you could possibly see it from. You know, back when I was younger, being homosexual was considered some sort of mental defect, a mental illness. And because it didn't harm anyone prior to AIDS, you know, the conversation was, if you're hell bent on going that way, go that way, because only God can judge you. This was the Black take in inner city Atlanta. And, you know, for some people, that still is the take. Because, you know, I don't want to assume, and I don't want anyone in your audience to assume that I'm saying AIDS is a gay disease. But prior to that outbreak happening, people were just sweeping things under the carpet. And again, when we are complacent with issues, it comes back to bite us in the ass. And so now we have a president that is licensing this type of lifestyle for children. You know, if you as an adult male or female want to go out and have a same-sex attraction, I really don't have any place to say anything against that, but don't expect me to stand idly by while you try to indoctrinate our kids to feel that that's normal, because it is absolutely anti-biblical, it is anti-Christ, and it's anti-normal. From a scientific perspective, any species that does not procreate is doomed to die, and homosexuality does not procreate. So it's a matter of science if you want to go that far.
All right. On that note, we're going to go to a commercial break and come back on the other side and talk about your family's history, a rich family history with science.
This is a special report.
Knowing how to invest your money is harder than ever before. Dealing with stock market volatility, record debt, and terrorist attacks requires new thinking. At U.S. Asset Management, we can help you see the world more clearly so that you can move beyond the chaos and invest with confidence. Call us, visit us online, or drop by our office. U.S. Asset Management, helping you make better decisions with your money.
If you haven't noticed, gold has reached a new high, all-time highs, actually, and keeps going up every day. Why is that? It's because precious metals are a long-time historical store of value. And if you own a portfolio and you have assets in the fiat currencies, i.e. stocks, bonds, cash, or whatever, you're vulnerable to hyperinflation, which is coming as our debt explodes another trillion every 90 days. It's really scary. So how do you protect yourself? Go to Advisor Metals. If you look on any of our CDM.press sites, about halfway down, there's an ad for Advisor Metals. Click on it, fill out the form for your contact info, and Ira Bashatsky will contact you and talk to you. It's an easy conversation. There's no sales pitch. He's completely verified by us. He has a regulatory background we've checked into. We've checked with his bankers. We've checked with his IRA custodians for metals. And we can highly recommend Advisor Metals and ERA. So go to Advisor Metals. If you call them directly, tell them we sent you at CDM, and he'll definitely take care of you. But protect your portfolio, because you really need to. It's coming. Thank you.
Okay, so we are back with one of our colleagues who writes for us and contributes on Georgia Record, Dr. Lisa Babbitt. She's probably one of the more educated of all of us on this network. But Lisa, I am fascinated, not just that, you know, you're so articulate and eloquent in caring, and your passion is clear to me as you're running for state senator in Georgia from Gwinnett County, you know, in District 5. But your family history is extraordinary. So your mother was African-American. Your father was of British heritage, but he was also born in Australia. Correct. And they ended up in Atlanta, where they met, because your grandfather on your paternal side had a passion for fighting alongside Martin Luther King. So tell us about this, because I think it's when I got into reading about it, I thought it was absolutely extraordinary.
Well, I'll say, first of all, my grandfather, Stuart Barton Babbage, he's an Anglican priest. So that probably lent itself to this kind of ministry and outreach. But honestly, it started with an outrage because in Australia at that time, Blacks could not immigrate to Australia. It was actually against federal law. And simultaneously, there was a stolen generation of Aboriginal children that were unraveling. Their story was unraveling at that time. And so, burdened with his calling in Christ, he decided to go somewhere where he felt like he could make a difference, making no difference in his native country as a result of the federal law. So he heard of Martin Luther King. He brought his family to Atlanta. He moved into a predominantly Black neighborhood and became the priest over a Black congregation in Decatur, Georgia. This is back in the early 60s. My father was 17 when he came. I'm sorry, he was 14 when he came to Atlanta.
So that your father's name is Christopher?
Correct.
Okay, so Christopher is living in a Black community in Atlanta with a father with British heritage, and we're going to get into that in a second. That goes back to the 1700s. Yeah. Which is, in British history, is one of my favorite periods of time, because that's when Thomas Clarkson, William Pitt, Wilberforce were fighting slavery in the British Empire for almost 40 years. Yeah. So how did your parents meet?
So they met in the library on the campus of Georgia State. My father, funny thing, so in Australia, their education system was so more advanced than America that when the family came over, they all tested out of all of their classes in high school. But my grandfather, recognizing their age and vulnerability, decided to make them go through these classes regardless. So my father actually entered Georgia State at 16, and my mother was working in the library, having grown up in Grady Holmes Housing Project, which was just a stone's throw from the campus of Georgia State.
So let's get into a very favorite part of your family heritage. Well, first of all, before we leave that, I mean, so your parents got married, and then what happened to their lives?
Well, I'm going to say this, you know, my mother going to Catholic school, being very ideological, being a Beatles fan, she heard my father's voice across the campus of the library's campus and said, that's going to be my husband. So she went into this with a very naive understanding. Whereas my father went into the American experience with eyes wide open and hands wide open. And that was the cusp of the hippie culture. So they both lived a hippie lifestyle for quite some time. It's ultimately what led to their divorce. But I mean, I remember as a young child living in a nudist colony, what amounts to a nudist colony for some point of time. And eventually when my parents divorced, very traumatically, very aggressive divorce, that's when we ended up in the homeless shelter and eventually came back to Georgia from Arizona.
So when they got married, they got married in the church that your grandfather was a vicar at. And that was the first interracial marriage at that church.
It was the first at that church. Absolutely. It was the third in the state. And they received permission because my grandfather was so high up in the Anglican Church. He was not a vicar of the archdiocese, but they held the church there. They held the wedding there, I should say. And it, you know, at some time later, my mother wondered if they actually removed it from the record, but it's still there, and their first interracial couple to be married in the Episcopal Diocese in Atlanta.
Did you ever have conversations with your parents about getting married in the 1960s as an interracial couple in the South?
You know, many conversations have happened since, and my grandfather is truly the driving force behind that. Now, my parents fell in love of their own accord, but the push to get married versus live in sin was something that my grandfather advocated for. My mother always tells the story how she, my father was transferred to Temple University in Philadelphia. My mother ran away to be with him. And you can imagine having her mother, my grandmother, a Black woman in the ghetto, picking up the phone, calling at all times of night, saying, "Where's my daughter?" So my grandfather, the priest, said, "If you love this girl, you're going to marry this girl." And gave my dad the credit card, and he went and bought a wedding ring. But, you know, so he really was the onus behind, you know, how I came to be. I don't think at that point anyone would have thought of having a child out of wedlock. Definitely frowned upon. They were in the midst of the culture, honestly. They were in the midst of the culture. And thankfully, my grandfather put his arms around them, both my grandparents, I should say, and helped them form a marriage. And, you know, I'm very thankful because I got a brother out of it as well.
It's a great story. Okay, let's go back in history because this is great. Okay, so the 1790s. When I think about this, because everybody that knows me knows I am not tech oriented. That's not one of my gifts in life. But you are actually the, I guess it's great, great, great. Is there another great?
I think there's four.
So you're the great, 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 great granddaughter of the man who is looked upon as the father of the computer.
Yeah.
This is a wild story when you think about it, because it goes back to Great Britain, goes back to the 1700s. Tell us a story about your great, 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 great grandfather.
His name is Charles Babbage, and he was the son of a banker. And I love the idea of his story of, you know, that was considered upper middle class or lower nobility in Victorian England, but you still had to make something of yourself. And so when he went to Oxford, he met three schoolmates, and the four of them formed this bond. In fact, there's a great book on the four of them called The Breakfast Club, I believe it is. And, you know, they formed a great bond around making Victorian England not just enlightened for nobility, but for the regular guy. You know, their life's work was to bring this new concept called science into every man's life and to truly shape them economically as a result of the benefits of science. So my grandfather was one of the four men that coined the word scientist, and they petitioned the crown. This is what I love. They petitioned the crown to pay for these kinds of experiments, if you will, these investitures that would truly make England the monumental force that it was. And many of his ideas were taken to the continent as well, and just bloomed and blossomed. And hence you have this intellectual revolution that took place at that time.
And they also incorporated, which I think is an interesting lineage for you as well, when you go forward in time, it was science and faith.
Yeah.
Science and faith.
Yeah.
And so there was a collaboration with a woman named Ada Lovelace, who was the daughter of Sir Brian. And she was considered, now she died, when I looked at the history of this, she died about when she was about 37 years of age. So they were contemporary. She was a younger sister, I think, of one of the three other friends of your great, 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 great grandfathers. But she was thought of as a computer programmer, where he actually had his engine. I think they called it the direct engine. That was the computer at the time. And they actually have copies of it. And it's been copied further in history to where we are today.
Right.
But when you did your lineage and your research on this, okay, did you know, when did you know about this history?
I knew about it from the earliest ages. However, I didn't quite believe it, and so therefore I couldn't understand it. You know, it's hard to hear about being connected to royalty and this great genius when you don't have food on your table. It's very difficult to comprehend intelligence of that level when you don't have notebook paper to do your math homework on. So for that reason, the stories were always circulating in the back of my mind. It wasn't until I think maybe ninth grade when I saw his name written in a book. And it was a book that we were studying in class. And as we were reading the book, someone turns to me and says, "Do you know this person?" And my answer was, "Yes, he's my great, great grandfather." You know, like, and so, and that's when I started realizing, okay, this is my heritage. This is my DNA. This is part of my story. And I started embracing it at that time. It was when I saw his name in print, again, back to the power of education, because I don't know, you know, having my parents separated so early and truly being somewhat distant from my father's side of the family, I don't know that I ever would have embraced it, because many in modern culture don't embrace the truth, thanks to Hollywood. You know, if you think about who is credited with the computer, you won't hear Charles Babbage, yet he was the father of the computer.
It's Al Gore who claimed that he started the internet. Remember those days? I certainly do.
You'll also hear about Alan Turing, because he was a homosexual, and that is goes back to our trans and LGBTQ conversation. You know, he is promoted in public. Ada Lovelace is promoted because she's a woman, but the originator, his name is never mentioned. And I will add to this, I found out just last year that he was one of the first code breakers in the Crimean War. We don't hear about those stories. So before, I can't even remember what the one for the Nazis called right now, but before that cipher was broken, my grandfather broke it in the Crimean War. Right. So these kinds of, this real history, which is what Blacks are always talking about. We want real history taught. Real history needs to be everywhere.
So let's talk about your family history in Australia, because Babbage is a big name in Adelaide, Australia. I know that from being down there. So when your family went from Britain to Australia, it's quite a heritage in Australia. So have you developed, you know, a sort of a reckoning with that as well?
You know, I am very thankful, again, to my grandfather, aunts, and uncles that live in Australia. They have welcomed me when I've come to visit. I'm actually an Australian citizen. That was something that my paternal grandmother ensured that both she, my brother and I would be. But, you know, having that pilgrimage to America, many of my aunts and uncles took on American spouses. And so all the kids in my generation, many of them are, you know, multicultural in that we're half American and half Australian. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for that reckoning was very easy. It was the Charles Babbage England royalty side of it that was a little more difficult. But, you know, just going through the history, you know, people in Australia generally, I find them to be very laid back. They're not braggadocious in any way, shape or form. So the idea of all these accolades is sometimes lost in that culture. But I will say that when my grandfather passed in 2012, the list of titles and the list of accomplishments took a long time to read. And so, you know,
it certainly does, because when the Babbage boys, as I call them, when they went down to Australia, they spread out and they were in different fields. But there were a number of brothers.
Yes.
I think there was, I can't remember the first names, but I remember there was one brother that went to Australia. And then his other brothers came a little bit later from England down there. But they, you know, initially, from my understanding, is they were in Adelaide. But then they branched out to different fields. And then one of them ended up, he had some financial issues, and he ended up going to jail. And this goes back like 3-4 generations. And then, you know, the couple of them moved over to New Zealand as well.
Absolutely. In fact, my grandfather was born in New Zealand on one of those trips. But I call them the Babbage boys myself. And even some of them came to the South Dakota area of America. You know, so there's a whole Babbage clan that's up in that general area that is related, you know, to me by one of those. I think there was 12 kids in that that one litter. And they kind of spread all over.
Okay, so what did they focus? Did they churchmen too? Did they?
You know, back in those days, pretty much everyone would call themselves a church man, but not in the same way that my grandfather was, for sure. We had several artists. We have a few politicians in Australia and one in the United States as well, who's a Democrat. But, you know, they just chose whatever their passion was. You know, I think that that faith vein, there was definitely a break between one of the sons of Charles Babbage, whose name is escaping me right now, but he was the one who kind of carried on the lineage. And then there was a break, and then my grandfather picked it back up. So, you know, they always talk about how in families, if you can't sustain it for three generations, it'll be lost by the fourth. And that was certainly true, I believe, in our family. But I am very thankful to the lengths that my father and my mother, my grandfather and my mother went to bring faith back to our family.
So you're in Atlanta, you have this heritage. Your father, your grandfather walked with Martin Luther King. What's your relationship with the King family today?
Dr. Alveda King is a great friend. I've been thankful enough to be in her presence on numerous occasions and be invited to her house for Thanksgiving. You know, I will say that knowing of the great heritage that the Kings have, it does, the Babbage heritage does pale in comparison as far as local knowledge, but I really think that there is a camaraderie of kinship there between us, and I adore her. You know, she always answers when I call. And then as for Yolanda King, I have been able to spend some time with her as well, just because, you know, I was raised going to Ebenezer Baptist Church. You know, we went to the Baptist Church and we went to the Catholic Church because I went to Catholic school, but, you know, that was the community. I could walk to the King Center from Grady Homes where I was raised. And so that was always just an understanding. And I think many people who have been raised in Georgia feel that same way about the King family, whether it's real or imagined. But I am happy to say that Alveda King is a friend.
All right. You mentioned Frederick Douglass, one yes. of my great historical heroes. And most people don't understand that he was a great orator. And he was also international. When he went to Ireland, I think it was 1857, He said that what he saw in Ireland at that time was worse than what he saw in terms of slavery back in America, especially in the eastern shore of Maryland. How do you reconcile with this extraordinary international perspective within your family, okay, and the interracial marriage? What do you think about when people get stuck on 1619, on reparations? Mm-hmm. What do you have any feelings about that?
I do. But I'd like to say, first of all, that, you know, when we are fed trauma and we are fed this victim mentality, there's nothing else that you can look at. So you really have to avert your eyes from this whole ideology that you are the perpetual victim in order to have any other kind of concept of truth. But, you know, I think I've struggled with the idea of reparations and what the true solution could be for many years. And my latest musing is something called, why is it leaving me now? Reciprocity. Mm-hmm. So I feel that there are certain families, and I know we've seen this in California, we've seen this in other places where, you know, the family has documentation to say my home was taken by the government because of XYZ. That is a clear case that can be argued. What we can't do is pay everybody for everything, obviously, because everyone, and I always bring up the Irish, and not only was I married to someone of Irish descent, it's just the little known fact, especially in urban communities, that the Irish were treated as slaves or worse. And so I love bringing that up because people don't think of whites in that capacity, but truly everybody who could have been has been a slave at some point. And everyone, you know, as you and I were talking, everyone has, you know, perhaps had stories where the government took advantage of them in some way or another. So we can't go down that road. But what we can do is, on a case-by-case basis, look at this idea of reciprocity for families who, especially in America, were not given the opportunity for generational wealth. And let me add to that, the reason why this thinking has developed over the years is because we see that, you know, many in the liberal media and mindset are relentless at drilling down this racism thing until it can't be drilled anymore. And so for our country to move forward, we're not going to move forward in some kind of false joy that Kamala Harris is spreading. We're going to move forward in truth. And part of that truth has to be recognizing that in this country, not all around the world, but in this country, Blacks were disowned that right to have generational wealth in some regards. And it's not everybody, because we know Blacks own slaves. I mean, let's look at Kamala yet again. Her family historically owned slaves. So it's not about Black or white. It is truly about, okay, here's what happened, here's what we can prove, and here's what is due those individuals for that. Not a blanket statement of 40 acres and a mule. That time has come and gone. So the word reparations, for me, lacks validity, because you cannot repair slavery in my life for what happened to people I never met. And I cannot punish someone who I never met for what they did to those people. So part of building our country forward, I think we do talk about reciprocity. And I think we do look at things at a case-by-case basis, and it not be based on color, but it be based on dishonest actions by our government.
You know, that brings Tuskegee up to me, because, I mean, that went on for 40 years.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the 1970s that they had the hearings on it. It was actually Bobby Kennedy's uncle, Teddy, who was a senator from Massachusetts, who oversaw the health committee when they talked about that. Let's talk about, because we've only got a short period of time.
Sorry, guys, you got to end it. Sorry.
Oh,
new show.
Thanks. Okay, well, anyways, I just want to say thank you, Lisa, for joining us today. And we'll get back in touch with you, and we'll have you back again.
Absolutely. We'll talk Tuskegee next time.
That's right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.